Thank you, Alex and Adrian, for organizing this very nice workshop on QPV. And I think it's super nice that over the years, this kind of circle of ideas is addressing so many areas, and I think it's very exciting. I will give a Blackboard talk, and the idea for me is to present you like the roadmap we have to try to attack the problem of giving exponential lower bounds using these function analysis techniques. Of course, I will not show you the proof that it can be done because we don't have it, but I will show you where we are, the things we have proven along the way, and so that at least you have an idea of what we are trying, and of course happy to give details later to anyone interested. So that's a kind of a project that started really long ago in 2010 at the MITAC Loeffler with Marius Junge and Carlos Palazuelos. Of course, we couldn't do anything in that respect, but we started to analyze simpler scenarios by then. And then, like 4 or 5 years ago, Alec Kubicki, in his PhD that I co-supervised with Carlos, he really managed to do the best, I think, the main important steps. There, in any case, what we analyze in a paper which is published, something like Geometry of Banach Spaces. Spaces, something like a new route towards position-based cryptography. This is CMP 2022. So we analyze a restrictive scenario, but we realize later that indeed the same techniques can deal with the general one, and this is what I'm going to present. But I'm going to present is not written anywhere, so please consider it as work in progress. Many details still have to be checked, but that's the idea. But essentially all the main techniques are already, you can find them already in that paper. So that's what I mean. So what's the idea? Many of the things I'm going to tell now started indeed discussing with Alex Main when he was visiting Madrid. And in previous discussion we had together with Alec in order to see possible ways to apply our techniques in the holography context. He's part of the team, though his background is not function analysis as opposed to ours, but the setup, indeed, as you said, we are doing not QPV, but we are in the adversary point of view, so instantaneous non-local quantum computation. I think these were Florian's, no? And this is your acronym, I think, or no?
No, I
didn't. Whatever.
I used it today, but...
But the thing is that we are looking from the point of view of the adversaries. We are playing a non-local game in which we have like this simultaneous two-way communication, and we'd like to do something. So essentially, there is some referee that gives quantum questions to Alice and Bob. Here is Alice. Here is Bob. So they can pre-share some entanglement, and they do a first operation in which they part of the information they keep, part they send. They do a second operation, and they answer A and B. Essentially, if there is some initial state shared by referee Alice and Bob, some initial one, they are asked to prepare a final one also. No, that's a bit the idea. Which is our approach to that is the following. So the abstract way to look at the problem, you see there probably, yeah, okay. So which is the abstract approach is, this is like a non-local game. And then we can somehow, so we have like a non-local game. And along the years, we managed to somehow, essentially this is, can be seen like a kind of an element in some, let's say, n-dimensional complex space. And then somehow the value of the game, which is what usually one calls to the optimal probability of winning, optimizing overall strategies. So the value of the game is just some norm on Cn. And somehow this approach was kind of very successful to attack or to address more restrictive families of games. So for instance, with just no communication at all, like the usual Bell scenario in which the questions are answers are classical, or even no communication with quantum questions and quantum answers, or even one-way communication. And okay, we could prove, I think, several nice results there. But this simultaneous two-way communication, I mean, is much harder. And then once we have that, what we'll do is we'll consider like a random family of games that depend on some random variable. And we'll try to estimate. So we essentially, we know that the value of the game, this is the value of the game, which is somehow the optimal probability of winning. We know that, I mean, if we are in a QPV scenario, we want this to be sufficiently close to one. Okay. Because of this, this should be essentially the same as the expectation value of some, I mean, say X epsilon, some element on this norm space. And now this puts us in the position of analyzing averages of random vectors in a norm space. And there's a very rich theory about these things that goes back to the 70s, at least, that we plan to use in order to give nice estimates on the parameters of the game. So for instance, if in the game we say that, for instance, these objects are, this A and B have dimension D, E has dimension D sub E, and the communication C has dimension DC, okay? So we expect, or we want, to obtain here something of the form log DE plus log DC over D. So this is what we aim to get. So this implies that in order to have a strategy that gives a value close to one, either the entanglement or the communication must grow exponentially with the parameters of the game, with the dimension of the inputs. Okay. So please notice that just by historical reasons, in Banach's space theory, we work with dimensions, not with number of qubits. Okay, number of qubits is log of the dimension, but since it's going to be exponential, also the number of qubits will be exponential. There is no problem there. Okay, so that's, but just.
Do you assume that C is equal for both sides?
Yeah, no, we don't need that, but for simplicity, yes. Yes, yes. Otherwise, we have D E left, D E right. I mean, but it's for simplicity, yes, 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 yes. Nothing changes. Okay, so that's the goal, the approach. Now, we'll do, yes,
so I will. The norm is somehow related to the game. For each different game, you have a different norm?
No, no, the norm is just related to the freedom in communication of the adversaries. Only depends on that, not on the game.
Where
so, of course,
does,
yeah, yeah.
Does the game come in then?
I mean, simply there is, you can interpret the game as just some vector here because there is just some, the description of the game is given by the input and the output,
okay.
Essentially only that matter. For us, okay, we will fix also essentially the, I mean, we assume that the way to bipartite this, so the dimension we keep here and we keep here, is independent of epsilon on the random variable. So we assume that. So we assume that this bipartition, just take the one which is an upper bound of all of them in a sense, and keep that forever. So this we'll assume. But yeah.
So you don't bound the local memory, let's see.
Only there. But okay, we assume, in a sense we do, because we assume this is unitary. So the product of these two dimensions might be the product of these two. So in a sense we do. If we fix the other parameters, this is fixed. Yes. So okay, so that's the goal. Let me now start to give details, but please ask questions.
Is related to the amount of entanglement?
Yes, in this case, yes. Or let's say communication times memory is entanglement times dimension. So it's related in a sense. Yes. Any other question? Okay, so in order to tell you which is the norm, which is the properties, how to bound these things, I need a bit of a crash course on these type of techniques. And probably most of the talk will be about that. Just because it's hard otherwise to grasp what we are doing. Anyhow, we don't know that. I mean, this is the goal, by the way, of course. I mean, otherwise the problem will be solved. This is the goal, okay? So that's not, okay. Okay, so let's go. Okay, so I assume everyone knows what is a norm. I mean, but it's simply just a way to assign a distance to a vector here with some nice property, which essentially is the triangle inequality. That's all you need. So we'll not do that. But essentially what I will explain to you is about this type of things. And this is the what is called the theory of type and cotype. This has been used also in theoretical computer science, so maybe people coming from this background know about that, but essentially the idea is how to estimate. Okay, by the way, I forgot to say that in our case, okay, now let's do that. So we have this. So let's call x to just Cn with some norm that we call norm of x. That's a normal space. And these objects, epsilon I, are just a Bernoulli variable, IID. Bernoulli. Meaning that you take plus 1 and minus 1 with probability 1/2. Okay, so essentially this is just we take some epsilon in the Boolean hypercube if this goes from 1 to n plus minus 1 to the n, and we sample with uniform distribution in the Boolean hypercube, so we have that. So we want to give estimates of that. So the goal of type and cotype is to give estimates of that. So the goal is to give estimates of that. Okay. Thus, and in order to motivate that, the best thing is to see what happens in a Hilbert space. So imagine I have a Hilbert space. And we know that in a Hilbert space, indeed, the fact that we have a Hilbert space is characterized by having the parallelogram law. So meaning that if I have two vectors, x1 and x2, and I compute the two. So I made a parallelogram with that. Okay, I don't know if it looked very parallelogram, but okay, it's a parallelogram. And these are the diagonals. Now we know that the length of one of the diagonals plus the length of the other one must be twice the length of the edges, no? So that's the parallelogram law, and that's what characterizes the norm being a Hilbert norm. Of course, I can put this 1/2 at the other side. Okay. And I can add like one half here. And then we have indeed something, if instead of taking the one norm, I take the two norm here in the integral. So this is essentially that for the case of two vectors. Okay? Where the constant is one here. So essentially, I mean, this essentially shows that if we generalize in a Hilbert space, we can generalize this and show that this is equal, this is in a Hilbert space, to this. Okay, that's simply generalization of this for more than two vectors.
So yes. When you added the power 1/2, why wasn't it added on the 1/2 in front of it?
Oh yeah, sure, sure, of course. I know here. I don't know. Of course, yeah, no, you should. And the thing is, here, of course, you need the other because you have repeated. I mean, plus minus ones here, so you have to count twice more. Yes, yes, yes. You're totally right. Yes, yes. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Okay. So.
Question.
Yes.
I think I missed it. So the Xi, are those randomly sampled?
No, Xi's are for any. So what is randomly sampled is only that.
Okay, so
this is true for any choice of vectors. This is true for any choice of vectors in my Hilbert space. So this is for any choice of vectors. We want these estimates for any possible choice. And we would like to show estimates that are somehow of this sort. Okay.
And for two, you know exactly that.
Sorry? For
N equals 2, you know exactly what the answer is.
Yeah, no, but this is for a Hilbert space only.
Yeah, for a Hilbert space.
Yeah, for a Hilbert space, exactly, this can be generalized. And we know that this is exactly equal to that for any choice of vectors. So Hilbert space solved. And now essentially, type and cotype are ways to estimate how far this is to be true. In a Banach space now, in a normal space, which is not a Hilbert space, which doesn't have this property.
Why is it called type and cotype?
Okay, this is, I don't know.
But what's type and what's cotype?
I will show you. So type is one of the two inequalities, cotype the other one. But that's the idea. Okay, so essentially now, can you see upstairs? Okay. So now the idea is how far, no, I should, okay, maybe, oh, there is a, okay, okay. How far is that to be true for a normal space which is not a Hilbert space? Okay. So essentially, the definition of it's called cotype 2. Okay, there are several things. I don't know if it's not okay, but okay. The fact that in this expectation value you take the L2 norm is totally irrelevant. There is something called Cahan's inequality that you can take anything there. I mean, you can put P 1 over P or just 1, it's totally irrelevant. What you get at the other side, this is not irrelevant. That's what defines the type on cotype. So I will define cotype P, cotype 2, but you can define cotype P for other LP norms. But cotype 2, constant, the cotype 2 constant of X, a normal space X, is the minimal T, oh, C, so that C over expectation value sum I epsilon I xi, 6.5, less or equal than this. Okay, for all xi's in x. Okay, so the cotype constant is the minimum constant you can put here so that this is still true for all possible vectors. It's a priori not obvious that there exists such a thing, but it exists. yes, because this is a property which is preserved by Banach-Mathur distances, essentially, and then, okay, in finite dimensions. No, in infinite dimensions, of course not, but in finite dimensions, Yeah, you can always bound this by the distance of the normal space to be in a Hilbert space. And this is always finite dimensional. It's bounded by the square root of n, so for dimension n. So that's always possible. And the type is the opposite. Type 2, constant. T is the minimal T, so that the opposite is true. Oh, sorry. Expectation value, sum I epsilon I xi, square 1/2, less or equal than T times this, OK? For all xi. Okay, so essentially it's one side or the other side of the inequality.
Yeah, so is there a reason why you need to go to something that is not a Hilbert space?
Because the norms we will get here are definitely not Hilbert space norms. So we need to deal with
that. You can associate this with a vector like that is Hilbert space, right?
No, but what we associate a norm to the value of the game. And this has nothing to do with a Hilbert space. Okay. It will be very far from Hilbert spaces. Okay? So that's more or less what we need. Okay, so let's keep going. Any questions so far? I think it's just random estimates. Now what they want to tell. Okay, good. Now, okay. Associate, if I have X a norm space. I can construct the dual space, which is essentially the set of linear functionals from Cn to C with a norm given by the max in x less than 1 of L of x. Okay? So essentially, the dual, which is, of course, also isomorphic to Cn. Okay. It's just the set of linear maps from Cn to C. And the dual norm is the maximum of what you can get in the output if you optimize in the unit ball of the input. Okay. That gives you the notion of a dual norm of a norm. Okay. And now there is a nice duality between the type of one space and the cotype of the dual space, which makes sense because inequalities get reversed in the dual. And the inequality we care about, this one is only the type 2 to cotype. Essentially, the cotype 2 of x is bounded. Okay, when I say bounded, it's up to universal constants. Type 2 this is the cotype 2 the cotype 2 constant of x, and this is the type 2 constant of x star. This we don't care. We care about the other one. So this is something we don't care about. But this is what we care. And this is not as good as this one. We need to pay a price which is the log of the dimension of x times c2 of x. Why? Okay, it's not something I can explain now, but that's what we care about. So essentially, this X star here, sorry. Of course.
Is this something tight?
Yes. You need that. Yes. Definitely. Yes. This is even true for L1 and infinity. So this norm is just the maximum of the coordinates or the sum of the coordinates, you already get this log. So yes. Okay, so.
So these are the type and co-types of the duals?
Exactly. So essentially, because going to the dual essentially reverse inequalities, makes sense that having this inequality in one space would imply that in the dual and vice versa. Okay, this is almost true. And so it's true if you pay the price of log of the dimensions. But we are happy to pay price of log dimensions. Log dimensions is okay. So it's not a problem for us. Okay, so. Why cotype? In a sense, we would be interested in type 2 constants But in a sense, cotype 2 are nicer. And the reason they are nicer is because cotype 2 estimates are related to something which is, in a sense, more geometric, which is what is called the volume ratio. Okay, so next concept is volume ratio. Which is another way to measure how far you are from the Hilbert space. So in a sense, if you have a norm space, the unit ball, so the given x, we can consider the unit ball of x, which is just the set of elements with norm 1, or less than 1. And this unit ball can have very different geometries. I mean, can be, for instance, I mean, just in two dimensions can be something like that, for instance, no? So this is, these are the axes. So that this is, for instance, for the max, the norm of the max of the coordinates that the unit ball, or can be like that for the Erwan norm, or can be many things. No? So in order to see how far this is from the Hilbert norm, with, of course, the unit ball is just a ball, we can consider the quotient between the volume of the ball and the largest Hilbert ball I can put inside. So the volume ratio of x is the volume of the unit ball of x divided by the volume of epsilon of x, and we, okay, 1 over the dimension of x. Just simply to normalize, because volumes scale, are to the power of the dimension. So in order to have something which is called like a radius, we have to divide by, to do 1 over the dimension. But epsilon x is the ellipsoid with largest volume inside B of x. And ellipsoids are unit balls of Hilbert spaces. Okay, so it's 1-to-1. So that's essentially the same. Okay, so that's, again, here, for instance, it would be like this, here we like this, and so on and so forth. Okay? Yeah.
Why do you have 1 over dimension?
Yeah, it's to, because the volume of a ball is essentially some number to the dimension of the space. And in order to kind of filter out that, in order to get something which is dimensionless, we just talk more about the radius, or effective radius, more than about the volume. That's what we're talking about. That's, again, it's a convention thing. Okay. Okay. And now, nice thing is that there is a nice connection between volume ratio and cotype. So that volume ratio and cotype 2, which is the following, the volume ratio of x is upper bounded by, maybe I have to pay a price of a log 2, let me just double check, yes, log, yes. Log dimension cotype 2 of x, and this was proven by Bourgain and Vitaly Milman in the 80s. Okay, so one can estimate the volume ratio by the cotype 2, but we would like to have the opposite inequality. And
so, why are we interested in this volume ratio?
Exactly. The reason is that computing the type 2 constant, that is what we really need, because we have this and we want an upper estimate. Upper estimates are given by type 2 constants. But computing a type 2 constant is very hard. So what we can do is we can go to the dual and try to compute the cotype 2 constant. It's as hard as the type 2. And if we could relate this to volume ratios, this is way easier, because computing volume ratio is much easier. Indeed, we can compute the volume ratio of all this normal space that we get. So it's not trivial, but it's doable, and this we could do. But unfortunately, the inequality goes in the wrong direction. So can we get, I mean, a reverse inequality? And the answer is no in general. No reverse inequality in general. But yes, I mean, it's known that it doesn't exist, so there are counterexamples. But yes, if we restrict to subspaces, Okay, so essentially what is true, and okay, I say essentially, because for the purpose of what we want is true, but I mean, as such, it's not proven, but okay, or at least not that I know. Essentially what is known, what is true, is the following, is that we can estimate the cotype 2 constant by, again, log dim. And now we take the sup in the volume ratios of the subspaces of X. Okay? Having to consider all possible subspaces make this also hard. And we don't know yet how to do that, but okay, that's something we could try, okay? So essentially this shows, because in the end, okay, I will show you the norm that appears, and the evidence we have for this to be true, or at least one of the evidences, is because we can compute volume ratios of the space and some of the subspaces, and all of them match that. But so far we cannot compute the sup in all possible subspaces. That's also probably very hard, but okay. Okay, but that's a bit there.
Somehow it's good enough to have an educated guess of a subspace and then.
Exactly. Yes. I don't know. Okay. Yes. I mean, on the other hand, probably. Yeah. Okay. So let's put this way. This also points in the direction of some conjecture, saying that if the space X has sufficiently many symmetries, maybe the reverse implication is true. And the reason is that you have enough symmetries. I mean, all subspaces cannot differ that much between each other, okay? Because there is a symmetry map mapping one to the other.
And do you get equality in this case? Essentially,
up to log, yes.
So it's equal to
up to log dim, yes. Okay. So that's a bit the picture, and let's go back.
It reminds me a little bit of this Yarrow principle in complexity theory.
Ah, what's that?
Well, it says how you can express somehow the complexity of randomized algorithms in terms of deterministic algorithms with some distribution of the inputs, and then also the worst case distribution that somehow equals the randomized complexity. In.
Ah, that's nice. Okay.
So the tool, because you can guess then the distribution and
I see.
Work it out for that.
Okay.
And that's sort of proven by Minimax principle or by the duality of linear programming.
I see. Ah, okay.
Sometimes, somehow under the hood here as well.
It's a good question. Maybe these techniques could help because of course these all are convex sets. I mean, these unit balls are convex sets, so probably one, and so this one is the dual of the other, and so maybe these techniques that were developed for linear programming duality could be helpful here. I don't know. So
is there somehow a fixed point theorem in the proof here?
No. That's the implied. There is no other proof. Maybe using that then. No. Yeah. Okay. Nothing. Thanks. That's something to explore. Definitely. No, super. Okay. So last thing we need, two more ingredients. As I said, most of the thing is about ingredients. So is the theory of cross norms by Grothendieck in the 50s and interpolation theory from Calderon in the 70s or 60s or something. So just a few words of that. So what should I do? Probably I can erase this part. This is just a bit here. Okay, so, and now we can go back to the game. So essentially the.
And you have to give an example of these norms and games.
Yeah, exactly. I'll go back to that and give exactly which is the norm we get. So I will specify totally the norm. But we need all these for that. So next is the theory of cross norms. And this goes back to Grothendieck in his PhD, indeed, in the 50s. Essentially, is I have some pair of norm spaces, X and Y. And I would like to define a norm in the tensor product, which is compatible to the norm of that, and the tensor. So essentially, a cross norm is some norm alpha on X tensor Y. So that, I mean, if you have an elementary tensor, this is the product of the norms. Okay, makes sense? Compatibility between the tensor product and the norms. And the same is true for the dual. So now if I have T times S, now this is as a map, this is in the dual space, so in the sense that T in essentially X alpha Y dual, this should be also equal to T in X dual times S in Y dual, okay? So we have an element in the dual of X, so a linear map acting on X, an element in the dual of Y, a linear map acting on Y, and we consider now T tensor S as an element in the dual of that. Again, you should have multiplication of norms. So that happens in the space and in the duals. So that's all, that's the definition.
And for what tensor product?
This is
for the normal tensor product.
Exactly. So no, this is okay. Once you define a norm here, you have immediately the notion of the dual space, as I defined there, and in the condition one is that you have that the norm of the elementary tensors is the product, and condition two is that this happens also in the dual, and with these two things, an assignment of a norm here is called a cross norm. One nice thing is that there is a maximum and a minimum cross norms just coming from this definition. So there is a notion of minimum cross norm, which is called epsilon. And if I have an element in the tensor product.
But you can always do this.
There is, what I mean is that any cross norm is larger or equal than this minimum cross norm, and smaller or equal than the maximum one. So they are really the minimum and the maximum. And this is just the sup in T in X star S in Y star of this T X Y times S Y Y. And the maximum one cross norm is pi of C, and this is the inf in the sum of xi, yi, where the inf is taking on all the compositions of C as a sum. Okay. Like that, okay? So this is independent of the decomposition I chose. And here I take an inf from all possible decompositions like that. This is the kind of the analog of the separable.
I'm just trying to digest the definition.
Yeah.
For a Hilbert space, is every norm a cross norm, or are there?
No, no, okay, I mean, no, no, there are several cross norms you can put in a Hilbert space that gives rise to different objects. So there's one which is called the Hilbert-Smith norm that gives you another Hilbert space. Now there's a big good, let me do that for the Hilbert space, because essentially, we will use those. So essentially, for instance, if I have a Hilbert space of dimension D, let's call L2D, and I do the epsilon L2D, this is S infinity D. So this is just matrices, D-dimensional matrices with the norm of the maximum singular value. And if we do the maximum one, this is the trace class. Oh, sorry, this is D. This is D. So this is the Hilbert space of dimension D, Hilbert space of dimension D. This is just the set of operators with the operator norm. And if I put the maximum one, this is the trace class. dimension D. So there are matrices with a trace norm. So these are the two extreme cases. And in the middle, you have the Hilbert-Smith norm that gives a Hilbert space here. And this you obtain by interpolating this and that. And that's the next and last notion I need, which is the interpolation of norms. So that's.
And all these are cross norms.
All these are cross norms, yes. Any cross norm is bigger or equal than this one, and smaller or equal than that one. By these two properties. Okay, so.
Sorry, the cross norm, the definition, it doesn't seem to make reference at all to the original norm. Like the thing on the right hand side looks like it's infinity naively.
Oh, sorry, this is the unit ball, of course, thank you. No, that's in the unit ball, and that's in the unit ball. Thank you, yes, I forgot to write that they have norm less than equal than one. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you, yes, of course, thank you, yes.
So the max norm is related to the separability.
Yes.
Is there any kind of QI interpretation of the min norm?
No, it's kind of the dual, it's in the, but.
Right.
I mean, it appears very naturally in non-local games. Because it usually refers to the value without entanglement of a game. Essentially, both in Bell inequality lie with classical inputs or outputs, but also with quantum inputs and quantum outputs. If there is no communication at all, the value without entanglement is just the epsilon. But apart from that, and this, of course, that is just the operators. I don't know if there is any direct quantum info. Yeah, good question.
Can't you think about this as witnesses or something?
Yeah, of course, it's a kind of a dual, maybe the witnesses of separable states. Yes, of course, that's a duality thing. Yes, you're right. Yes, thanks, Andreas. Yeah. Okay, so last thing is interpolation. And okay, this is technically very hard to define, but let me just tell all one needs. And that's it. Essentially, last thing is interpolation. Essentially, if I have x and y normed spaces, I would like to find a space which is somehow in between the two. Not like we interpolate points. So we can define x, y, 1/2. Okay, 1/2 can be changed by any parameter theta, but 1/2 is like the middle point, essentially. This is an intermediate space. Can be, of course, defined formally. And it has a nice property that if I have a map T linear from CD to CD, so that the norm of T as a map from X to X, okay, let's put it this way. I define the norm of a map is the max of the norms of the outputs, where I restrict the norm of the inputs to be less or equal than 1. No? So it's the maximum ratio between the norm of the output and the norm of the input. Okay? So now, an intermediate space, this interpolation space, interpolated between that. So essentially, if I have a linear map, so the norm of T as a map from the interpolated space to itself is less or equal than the norm of T as a map of X from X to X 1/2. Times the norm of T as a map y to y 1/2. So that's the key property of interpolation. And this was defined in order to analyze boundedness of linear operators in motivated by PDEs. If you know the Fourier transform, things like that, if you know it's bounded from some spaces, and you would like to show it's bounded from other spaces, this is kind of why it was invented, this technique. But it turned out to be very, very useful in many other areas. For instance, if you want an example, here, the interpolation space between this and that is just the Hilbert-Smith norm. So it's just taking the Hilbert space again. So for instance, in an example, if we do S1D, S infinity D, 1/2, this is S2D, which is just the Hilbert space. So it's L2D squared. It's just the Hilbert space of dimension D squared. Okay. And there are many. Something in between the trace class and the operators is just Hilbert spaces. No? So that's one example, but there are many others. So this is the notion of intermediate space. And this is exactly what we will need, because what we will need is just the interpolation space between the epsilon and the pi norm. So So this is exactly the norm that appears there. It's an interpolation between the epsilon and the pi, which in this case is a Hilbert space, but there is not. OK, I know I went very fast. There were many things, but I needed that just to state the claim. So let's go. Let's go back to games and now explain what we have. Oops. Go up. Oh, okay, now, good. Okay, so back to the last 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Let me just explain why all this. But as you see, I mean, there are a lot of all these theories, I mean, are there since the 60s, 70s, 80s, so there are many, many techniques results that we can use, and that's why it's interesting to make the connection.
I read in this definition of intermediate space, you have less than or equal, but then when you...
No, but this is about the linear operators. So also in this case, it's less or equal. So there are cases in which it's strictly less.
Okay.
Yes. So it doesn't need to be equal in general. Yes. Even for this simple case. I don't know. Keep this from going up? Okay, I don't know. Okay, so now back to the game. I think I need, I have all I need. So now back to the game. So let me use it here. Okay, so so which is the game in our case? So in our case, so we have to define for each element epsilon in the Boolean hypercube n square. Or say d squared. I'm going to define the game simply by specifying that the input state is just 1 over d sum ij, ij in the referee, I to Alice, j to Bob. Okay? And the output state, I call it f of final state, is same, but now with epsilon ij here. Okay, that's the game. Okay, the game is to implement a unitary which is diagonal in the computational basis.
Some funny faces.
Exactly, which are essentially random faces. Okay, random plus minus one faces. Okay, that's what. Because again, I will sample this later. I mean, now there's no sampling. It's just I fix epsilon. Epsilon is known to everyone, so it's just known to the players. So everything can depend on epsilon. But of course, they have to do some global thing, in a somehow local way. No, so that's the thing. No. Okay, so. Okay, so. I don't know if I, okay, so let me, okay, I will make the claim. I can give details, but I don't know if this may be overwhelming already, but let me just do the claim. So let's call this object T. Okay? And one important thing that I said at the beginning to a question of Harry is that this T is independent of epsilon. That's crucial. For us, okay.
What so do you mean by this thing?
This T is the way that communication is splitted.
So it's like a swap operation.
It's a swap operation between one part of the Hilbert space and the other, but which part is fixed? It doesn't depend on epsilon. Okay. So T is just a map that swaps part of the Hilbert spaces, and the only assumption we make, which I think is reasonable by taking kind of upper bounds to all possible things, is that of course this can depend on epsilon. So of course you can use this to rearrange things as you want. But once the outputs are here, what is the memory? And what is communicated? This is independent of epsilon. And T is simply this map. Okay? That's T. So now, let me write down the exact object. So now we consider, so we can show, that's kind of the theorem one, that if I...
Oh, for all. all epsilon uses the same thing.
Exactly, for all, that's independent of epsilon.
So it's
a universal communication pattern, if you want.
But universal reconstruction or something.
It could be if the bottom two boxes.
Also,
no, we still have that. And this kind of depends on epsilon. It's simply that the way I split the space is always the same. So it's not that, for instance, for one epsilon, I decide to keep more memory and less C, and for the other, these dimensions are independent of epsilon, but I can always take the supremum of both and then make useless part of the thing. So I think this is no assumption at all.
It's not a restriction.
This is my feeling, unless I'm, maybe underseeing something.
Would it correspond to a situation where they don't know what game they're playing, so the referee...
No, but it's impossible. It's important that they know the game I'm playing, because of course, otherwise, epsilon must be an input to the game.
Well, but prior, so they fix their splitting, then they learn the game.
Exactly. This is what they do. This is exactly what they do. This is exactly what I'm assuming. I think is one can do that without loss of generality, but maybe one has to be careful about this claim. But I'm pretty sure this is the case, but never thought on a proof of that yet. Okay. So, but that's really an assumption for us. Okay. Okay. So now the value of the game. Where now they can do any entangled state, any operation here, and all can depend on epsilon because it's known to everyone, can be bounded by, okay, and that's theorem one if you want. Okay, 1 over d square, sum of ij, t times ij, ij, this vector. There's nothing that depends on epsilon here, except this epsilon ij that I forgot to put, but it's important. And now the thing is in some norm space X. And which is X? That's the key thing, is that is S1 d times C or DC. The interpolation norm between epsilon and pi here, S1 d. DC, epsilon, the same thing. Okay. Okay, this looks scary, and it is, but okay. But I mean, but okay, maybe less than one may think. So, okay, let's go back to, so that's the thing. So, so one important thing is that now this is something where we can apply type 2 and co-type 2 estimates. In the sense, the only dependency on epsilon here is linear, is there. So there is no other dependency here anymore. So the dependency of the strategies is just put in the norm. So this norm is essentially optimizing our strategies by definition. We have to work a bit, but that's what it is. And this may look scary, but look that this is just Hilbert spaces with tensor norms that are coming from the maximum and the minimum. Because remember that S1, okay, this is, this is the trace class but of rectangular matrices. This is just rectangular matrices from D to DC with the trace norm. So S1 is just tensor product of Hilbert spaces with the pi norm. So this is a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces, this also, and that also. So it's just many Hilbert spaces with tensor norms which are or epsilon or pi or the interpolation of the two, nothing else. So it's essentially as good as it can get because it's just Hilbert spaces. And the norms are the two most famous and their interpolation. But the interpolation with Hilbert spaces is even better because the interpolation makes it a Hilbert space again. So it's like nice. That said, let's assume we know, or we can compute the type 2 constant of that object. So then we know, as I said, in the type 2 norm, this is like that, and this is like that for every epsilon. Now we take averages. Okay, this is true for every epsilon.
So this is the value of the game?
Yes.
How is it defined?
Yeah, it's the optimum probability of winning. Winning meaning I measure in this state and in identity minus that.
Okay, so it's basically the inner product.
Exactly.
What's the optimal protocol?
Exactly. And they optimize over all entangled inputs right. and unitaries.
Right.
That's the value.
Swap test.
Sorry?
You do like a swap test.
I mean, it's simply I at the end measure. So once the referee has referee A and B, he implements a global measurement, which is just the final state, an identity minus that. And then the probability of obtaining this output. This is essentially how I define the value. Okay.
And your theorem is that this is upper bounded by this thing.
By this thing. And now, of course, if we take averages, so because I would like to use like the probabilistic method. I would like to show, okay, if something happens in average, there must exist one epsilon, so in particular one gain for which something happens, even if I cannot decide what it is. So then this is 1d squared epsilon this object here. As I said, having the norm or the norm squared 1/2 only changes a universal constant. This is Cahan's inequality, so I shouldn't care about that. So this is essentially the type 2 constant, 1 over d squared. And now the sum in ij of the norm of the inside, t tensor ij ij, in this weird space, square 1/2. Okay? This is how it is. Now let's keep estimating. Maybe here, and with that I'm done. Now we'll make some final comments about, okay? But essentially, the program we have in mind is exactly that. So now, let's keep computing. So this is t2x d squared. And now, we can lemma 2, or theorem 2 if you want, although this is too much to be called a theorem, but okay, let's say lemma. This object has norm less or equal than 1. So this object we can compute in that norm. And this is equal to 1 indeed. Okay, less or equal than 1. Okay, we can compute this internal part as 1. So now we have, this is from 1 to d. So we have d squared square root, so we have d. So this is exactly d. So this is type 2 constant of x over d. Okay? Now, conjecture is that the type 2 constant of x is exactly d, or bounded by d to the 3/4 times log of dc, essentially. Okay. So if this is the case, we are done, because we get 1 over d 1/4 times log dc. And we have this exponential bound. So why this conjecture? No, so
d to the 1/4.
Exactly. Using this conjecture here, we get exactly, essentially, log dc d 1/4. So in order for this to be close to 1, this must be exponential. Okay, that's the... So which is the evidence we have for this conjecture? Okay, we have kind of.
Who conjectured this?
We. No one before looked at this space. I mean, there was no reason for that, no?
Where did you get rid of the epsilon somehow?
Because
it's averaging, or?
Yeah, no, because the type 2 constant exactly does that.
That's exactly what is.
Exactly, type 2 constant, averages, expectation of averages like that are upper bounded by the norm of the inside. Of course, in the norm, the epsilon goes. So, okay, so that's it. So there's no. Okay, so what we can prove is that indeed, so that's more or less the idea, and of course the goal is to show whether this is true or not. So because of this connection with volume ratio, the one that probably I erased, but anyhow, so that there is a connection between volume ratio and cotype 2 of the dual, so volume ratio and cotype 2, and there is another relation between type 2 and cotype 2 of the dual, this is here. The only known kind of sanity check for a T2 type estimates is to compute the volume ratio of the dual. That's essentially the sanity check. So this we do. The volume ratio of the dual is really what it should be. It's really D^3/4. This is true. So essentially, if in this case volume ratio and cotype 2 were the same, and we know that to go from cotype 2 and type 2 of the dual, one has to pay a log, this is why we conjecture that. But as I said, I mean, the other inequality between volume ratio and cotype is not generally true. It's only true if you go to all possible subspaces, and that's something we cannot deal so far, but that's one thing. And the other thing is that at least the two constituents here that are joined by the epsilon norm, they do have the right type 2 constant. So the type 2 constant of each one of the constituents is the right one. Okay, so the S1D, DC, interpolation, epsilon pi 1/2, S1D, DC. This is really, this is that. This is true. Okay, these are the two, I'll say, evidences we have.
If that were not true, then the whole thing wouldn't be true.
Exactly. Because type 2 is generated by subspaces, and of course, this is a subspace of the whole thing. So that's the whole program. So let me just finish, sorry, I mean, just 2 minutes saying that, okay, now by imposing restriction on the attacks, we get simpler spaces. For instance, if we, okay, this is again work in progress, I think, because I did the computation yesterday night, so maybe it's wrong, but I think that if we assume that the dependency on the first round on epsilon is sufficiently regular in the sense that we have a bound on the average gradient, discrete gradient, then the norm one gets is just one of the two. It's just that. And this we can bound. So in particular, this would give that if the attackers in the first round must do something which, if I change epsilon just in one bit, the whole protocol is not far from if I don't change it. So essentially, there is some sort of continuity. Then if they restrict to that, then they require exponential entanglement. So essentially, if they do not have exponential entanglement, it's because the first round must change a lot by changing epsilon just in one bit. So one needs some sort of complicated attacks. So for instance, if we restrict the second round to be universal, like for instance in port-based teleportation or something that is natural in holography, then we get also things that we can compute. And also we get exponential overbounds. But if we go for the goal, for the final thing, then we get this mess. And so far, we have no clue how to compute that. So that's a bit there. And I think probably I should stop here.
The second AP not depend on epsilon anymore.
Exactly. If the whole thing is universal, then of course we also have bounds that are, again, essentially the same space. But yeah. But for me, again, this is something that please don't just trust me only with care. Because again, it's a competition I did yesterday that again, if really the first round behaves reasonably continuously with epsilon, already with that, we get exponential overbounds. I find this interesting if it's finally true. but that's something. Because again, we can then reduce this big mess to just one of the two, and we can prove really that one of the two has the right type 2 constant. This is not trivial at all, but we did it already in that paper. So that's okay. So that's the whole program. I apologize. It was a bit technical, but I mean, it's the only way to present the thing. And essentially, this is where we are. That's the beast we have to attack, and this is kind of the sort of techniques we have. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
If the organizers don't look at me angrily, then maybe we should allow a few questions.
Yeah.
I can point. So we have the expectation value over epsilon, but is there a way to know the worst case scenario? Or
No. No, I would expect that expectation value is worst case. This is usually what happens in many cases with these norms. But definitely, I don't, up to log, but logs, we don't care. So I would expect that expectation is worst case up to logs, but there's no, this is known for some less complicated norms, but for this one, I don't have any proof of that.
Yeah. Eric?
So are you using the assumption that C is a classical channel? Or sorry, quantum channel?
Quantum channel, yes. No, any channel. It's just simply bounding the dimension.
DE doesn't depend on the dimension. Here you have these parameters, right?
Yeah, but I'm using this is unitary. So essentially, DE and DC is the same. OK, essentially, DE times D is DC times D memory. So indeed, so there is a relation between DC and DE.
Okay,
I don't know if.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, Andreas, so far I didn't like count that also like, you need to communicate the epsilon ij, right?
Again, sorry?
I mean, so far in your like, comparison of like resources that the honest provers need,
yes.
The attackers need, you didn't keep track of like, the fact that they also need to send like the epsilon ij. For the game, right?
I mean, no, because this is known. I mean, the game is, one assumes,
right.
So epsilon is not an input or anything of the game, it's the description of the game. One assumes, I guess it depends very much on what you are thinking, but in our case, we say that the descriptive complexity of the game is not an issue. And epsilon is just a descriptive complexity of the game.
It's not, I mean, if you compare it, for example, to the routing or so, where you have to send like the X and the Y, I mean, like, sort of have to also like count the length of those, right? I mean, it's sort of, if you think about, like part of your protocol is that they have to sort of get the epsilon ij, and the honest prover has to basically prevail that. They then also like take like into account that they have to.
Yeah, I think it's very
counting the epsilon ij here is like counting the description of the function f in the
f role. Yes, epsilon is not an input. It's the description of the game. It's known by everyone from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just exactly it's just the description of the game.
Right. Okay.
So I'm sampling a family of games,
right.
And I'm saying, okay, if this is true, there exists one of those games. Okay, it's just an existence proof for which this happens. But there's no, it's nothing like it's not part of the inputs or anything like that.
Nothing.
So it's very different than what we did here. That's what I mean. So same technique, same ideas, but it's not the same.
All right. Yeah. This is what's
okay. Yes.
You're just asking them to perform some unitary that's diagonal, right?
Exactly. So we believe that the same should be true for a random unitary. But the thing is that all this time of random estimates, they are usually done for Gaussians or Bernoulli. I guess from random unitaries one could do the same, but probably it's less, one has to work harder even. But I guess same should be true for a random unitary, not just random diagonal, but just random from the hard measure. I would expect exactly the same techniques work, the same everything. So. Simply, this is we do diagonal for simplicity in the okay simplicity sense that we can really import many of these definitions, techniques, blah blah, blind in a sense without having to go through the conversions.
Should we have one final question? Yeah.
So this half in your interpolation space is well, do you have to do that or do you just want that because then you have this evidence at the end?
No, we have to do that. It's part of the description of the strategy.
Oh, okay.
So this half comes from the fact that you have entanglement. Arbitrary is entangled state here. So if you don't put that, you get epsilon.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks. So yeah, let's take the further questions for the break. Thanks again.